Welcome to Conversations with Peter Boghossian. It is a distinct pleasure and honor to welcome Sir Rajiv Malhotra, who is a truly remarkable man. I don't use the word wise very often, but Rajiv is a very wise man. And I had the honor of writing the foreword to Snakes in the Ganga, which is an incredibly important book. So we're going to talk about a lot of fun things. We're going to talk about anti-Semitism. Fun in air quotes. We're going to talk about Harvard. We're going to talk about Snakes in the Ganga, Rajiv's work, Rajiv's book, and the turmoil and chaos in which we currently find ourselves and the problems there within. But before we begin, Sir Rajiv Malhotra, it is a great honor. For those who are not familiar with your work, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, thank you for having me, Peter. It's always been a pleasure. And I want to tell people that you wrote the foreword to this book, Snakes in the Ganga. We'll talk about it in a moment. But my background, you know, I was born in India and went there, went to college as to become a physicist. At the age of 20, I came to the United States to do my PhD in physics and switched to computer science, and then pursued a career in computer science and in telecommunications very successfully in those days. And I left the corporate world and started my own ventures in 20 countries, some of them in what was called Eastern Europe, including one in Hungary, as a matter of fact, that I know you're associated with, and in Korea and Mexico and all kinds of places. And then I had an awakening, a spiritual awakening, that I should give back rather than accumulate more wealth. So in my early 40s, I exit all my businesses, and started the Infinity Foundation to discover myself, my heritage, what were the issues in the world, kind of like a one-man think tank, figuring it out for myself, and gave up all for-profit activities. This has been there for like 30 years now. So this is all I've done for the last 30 years. I was actually one of the first, probably the only Indian at that time, funding Harvard. I was funding Harvard, so I know what I'm talking about when I discuss Harvard, because I used to be their main source of funding for India studies, South Asian studies, for many years in the late 90s onwards. And that is where I discovered the deep bias, the hypocrisy, that rather than being true liberals, which they claimed to be, they were actually quite biased in many different ways. So that is when I shifted gears, and that led to my current journey.
Okay. So thank you for that. And I enjoy uncomfortable conversations, and we're going to have one. My first question is, so Harvard and other Ivy Leagues are in the news for anti-Semitism, although I think that the word anti-Semitism is kind of a weasel word. It just means, the way I interpret it and the etymology, it just means people who speak semantic languages, and often Arabs claim they can't be, or people who are Semites claim they can't be anti-Semites because they themselves are Semitic people. I personally prefer Jew haters, right. But that's a difficult term to swallow, but that's actually what it is. It's hating Jews. So in your book, nearly 2 years ago, you claim that Harvard is a nest of snakes, and they promoted Hindu phobia, which is something we don't talk nearly enough about, which we should be talking far more about. How is Harvard's treatment of Jews and Hindus linked?
Well, this is a very important point and not appreciated enough. I just discovered as a matter of coincidence that the people who are Hindu haters also tend to be Jewish haters and vice versa. And then I started looking at why are they so? And I saw some common factors. They tend to be leftists, tend to be wanting to topple old civilizations, identities that are doing well, people that are doing well. Indians are doing well in this country. Jews are doing well in this country. They tend to be anti-free enterprise. They want quotas. They want, in the name of fighting for the underdogs, they're actually toppling meritocracy. So I found all of these common things happening. And then I found that there was an axis between these people and the Islamists. It happened in India long before it happened here. It started happening here after 9/11 in a serious way, but in India it was going on for a very long time. So this axis of left and Islam And then in, being the protectors of the so-called oppressed, they were going around looking for any social group that had a gripe. And then they would say, okay, you know, you can join our coalition and we'll fight for you. This is what I discovered was going on at Harvard was the main center, nurturing this kind of scholarship, training people from India, bringing large numbers of scholars from India who were already kind of pre-trained a little bit on the leftist ideology. Then they would bring them here, finish off the job, give them certifications, send them back to India, and they populated a huge number of such chairs and professorships all over India in the liberal arts and humanities. So when you go to India, the universities there are similar in ideology to the Ivy Leagues in this country. They are full of such Hindu haters, Jewish haters, pro-Palestine, you know, and so on. So this was a huge discovery that I made, and it changed my life because I've spent the last quarter century full time fighting this kind of a menace.
Right, and so this is a kind of neo-colonialism that we're not talking about, that we should be talking about, from the very people who claim to be up in arms about colonialism. They themselves are now neo-colonialists. And in your book, Snakes in the Ganga, you also write about this is not just happening in India, this is just happening throughout the world. This isn't, let's be crystal clear about this. This is an American neo-colonial export.
Yes, this is very interesting. You know, something happened in India and something happened in the United States and they've merged. What happened in India was an import of Marxism. Way back, there were Marxists because of the Soviet influence. And when the Soviet Union died out, you know, those Marxists needed a home. So they became these post-colonial people and so on. Subaltern, they started subaltern studies, championing from people who were the underdog Spivak. And so forth. Yeah. Gayatri Spivak, Homi Bhabha at Harvard, a whole lot of them. And these people created a generation of Indian scholars. They got them funding to go to the United States, to places like Harvard, get them stamped as authorities, bring them back to India, and then they would become prestigious, occupy prestigious posts. So now we're in the second or third generation of these wokists, what we now call wokists, but they were just leftist people in India. And so the Marxist origins of this whole work is very clear to me because that's what happened there. And in the meanwhile, in the United States, you know, something has been going on where more around blacks. So while in the United States, the leftists got hold of the blacks, the Black Lives Matter movement, and they turned it into a Marxist movement. In India, they aren't blacks, but it was with Muslims mainly. And then with the those who were socially, you know, underprivileged people, they tried to make a lobby out of them, politicize them, weaponize them. So the two forces have been working in parallel. And that's why there is a commonality of Jew hating and Hindu hating.
Yeah, if anybody wants some data points on something you said earlier, Kenny Hsu's book on an inconvenient minority is excellent. Indians are also an inconvenient minority, and that this completely disrupts the systemic racism claim. So we have a bunch of clips. So we're doing something, Rajiv, on the channel that I haven't seen very much, if at all. We play clips, tweets, podcasts, and we ask our guests to comment on them. So, Gav, could you pull up some clips for Rajiv before we get back to the questioning? Okay. Okay, so, you know, play the clip, sorry. And Reed and I were just at I'm in London now. Reed and I were just at a rally, 50,000 people, which was fascinating on multiple levels. But one of the things that I wanted to talk about that I find fascinating is that Harvard's president spoke about safeguarding free speech on campus. This is a kind of hypocrisy that is just utterly mind-blowing to me. It is... James Lindsay called the iron law of woke projection. So you've called out this hypocrisy. And I was wondering if you could cite examples for people. where either you or you and other Hindu leaders got canceled by Harvard.
Yeah. I mean, most recently, a very well-known filmmaker, Vivek Agnihotri, he's a well-known filmmaker. He came to Harvard and he was booed and canceled, and they stopped his talk. But before that, a few years earlier, a very well-known Indian Harvard-trained economist who worked for Nobel Prize winners, who published with them, Dr. Subramaniam Swamy, he was canceled. He was removed from his faculty position because in India, he made a statement that the Indian Muslims are of Hindu origin because their ancestors were Hindus, which is historically true, because they didn't come from the sky. They were people who converted, and before they converted, they were Hindus. It's like saying that the Muslims in the Middle East at one point in time were pagans or polytheistic. Their ancestors were that. It is historical fact. So for that, he was ostracized. Somebody filed a lawsuit, which didn't go anywhere. But Harvard, because it's full of these activists, they decided that he was somebody they should get rid of. So he was relieved of his duties. They stopped letting him come and speak. That's a cancellation. Now, in my case, I used to give huge amounts of grants to Harvard University to have conferences on Indology, which is a study of India. It became a center for the study of Indology. We gave those grants. Twice I funded visiting professors to teach Hinduism. One was Ashoka Klujkar, a Sanskrit scholar. The other one was Arvind Sharma from McGill, a very well-known Hinduism scholar. And in the process of giving all this funding, I started engaging Harvard people. And I noticed that they wanted my money, but they didn't want me to ask too many questions. They would rather that I come, give the check, they will feast me, and they will parade me, give some nice pictures for me to publicize and look nice and famous. But they didn't want me to interfere. And I have too much of an interfering mind. I wanted to ask questions. So I started asking questions to their scholars. And I found that they had preconceived conclusions, and they did not have the data, they did not have the substance, the logic to reach those conclusions. And if somebody with my scientific training would start cross-examining them, they were very irritated. First, they would try to distract me and say, oh, no, you're too busy, you're too important, don't worry, we are taking care of it. But I do worry. I do want to know what the logic is. So they found me to be a kind of a nuisance and irritant, but at the same time, they needed my money. So this became a source of tension, and they canceled me. They started canceling me. While I would fund a conference, I would fund a program, but I was not welcome to come there and sit there and ask questions. I thought that they're supposed to be the bastion of free speech. They're supposed to teach their students how to think freely, how to ask questions. No. And it was exactly the opposite.
No. Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about that. Gav, please pull up the F. Greg Lukianos, FIRE report on Harvard. I think it's they received an abysmal rating. What is that? 276. I can barely see it on the screen, but they received an abysmal rating for free speech. I want to keep the conversation on Harvard, and I want to keep the conversation on this rabid Jew hatred. And let's do a couple of things there, particularly about Hamas. So Gav, please play the clip of the podcast that I sent out, and I want to listen to this. It's a very, very a good and very, very important clip.
10/7 happens. And I think within 36 hours or less, let's take Harvard as an example, the pinnacle of the woke process. They had all these student organizations immediately come out trying to justify this thing without any information, right? Because in the first 36 hours, obviously not nearly as much information was available as to exactly what happened than has been available now, as an example.
I should read the statement just so people have clarity. Please. Joint statement by Harvard, Palestine solidarity groups on the situation in Palestine. We, the undersigned student organizations, hold the Israeli regime entirely responsible for all unfolding violence. Today's events did not occur in a vacuum. For the last 2 decades, millions of Palestinians in Gaza have been forced to live in an open-air prison. Israeli officials promised to, quote, open the gates of hell, and the massacres in Gaza have already commenced. Palestinians in Gaza have no shelters or for refuge and nowhere to escape. In the coming days, Palestinians will be forced to bear the full brunt of Israel's violence. This is deranged and sociopathic.
My point is you have like 15 or 20 of these student organizations of all ilks, okay? So it's not just pro-Palestinian groups. It was like the Harvard Sikhs Association. Okay. Like Sikhs in South Asia are the most peace-loving people in the world. They're not pro-war of any kind whatsoever or pro-terrorism. So all these people write this thing which blames Israel. Okay. Then the school is totally silent. The school doesn't say anything. They neither completely disavow that statement, nor do they come out with a more reasonable statement. All these ex-faculty and ex-individuals, Larry Summers sort of leading, say, this is outrageous. Have an opinion. They come out with something that's milquetoast and middle of the road. Then they get soundly rejected by everybody yet again. Then the administration comes out and gives a cleaned up version that tries to allay everybody's anger. Because that the first statement, I think, basically essentially pissed off everybody on both sides. Then a bunch of alums who've already graduated or who've given money say, these student organizations are outrageous. We will not hire anybody who's part of this because their views are so immoral that we would never want these people part of our organization.
And so here it is, Bill Ackman said, I have been asked by a number of CEOs if Harvard would release a list of the members of each of the Harvard organizations that have issued the letter assigning sole responsibility for Hamas's heinous acts to Israel so as to ensure that none of us inadvertently hire any of their members. In other words, you must own your words, which is
what happens is individual students actually have to come out who are part of these associations that were signatories to the first release, had to disavow the statement and said, actually, I'm just an Indian student at Harvard Law School. There's a, Nick, maybe you can find this tweet of this like Indian woman from Colorado of Indian heritage. And she's like, you just get auto-recruited into these organizations when you join Harvard. So I'm like, well, wait a minute. This is a place that's supposed to be for like modern free speech, progressive thinking. And instead what happens is based on your skin color, you get auto-drafted into some association. Then you auto-sign any press release written by some person that you don't even see or approve. What is going on at these places? And these are the places that parents and kids are tripping over themselves, trying to get into. Kids will kill themselves if they don't get into. And these are the worst institutions in America, because back to Jason, what we talked about earlier, which is we need people who can think from first principles. Those kids are not it, and those institutions are not making them. And so if we want to have a point in time where when things like this happen, we can really figure out what happened in the past that was right and what can we do in the future, it's not this, and it's not this kind of thinking. And if you're going to a school, Harvard, Cornell, UPenn, Stanford, that are spinning out these kids, I think it's a real shame.
You're spot on. I mean, how...
Okay, there's so much there to unpack. There's just so much there to unpack. So before I go, do you have any comments on that?
Well, whatever he said, I agree with. In fact, I've been writing about this. In fact, our book, Snakes in the Ganga, talks about all this. Snakes in the Ganga is a case study picking Harvard as the leading woke center of intellectual production and dissemination of knowledge. And so this whole 800-page book is actually looking at department after department in Harvard and what they are doing, the media department, the social sciences department, even the public health people. Each one is covered separately and who funds it, and the whole ecosystem of Harvard is taken apart. I don't think anybody has done this before with Harvard per se as a huge case study. So whatever he's saying is absolutely true. I mean, I've experienced it that, the people who want to argue from first principles are not welcome. I don't even think that the Harvard, I have great respect for their STEM people. They're very brilliant people. But as far as social sciences and liberal arts is concerned, I don't come across too many faculty people who can think logically. I mean, this is a hell of a statement I'm making.
I have had
arguments trying to be very reasonable, trying to do it in private, trying to do it over a cup of coffee, or because maybe they're embarrassed in front of their class. And I find that their ability to think logically, to understand an argument where somebody's presenting some data, is just not there. Because they are reaching a conclusion. They want to reach a certain conclusion. And if your argument doesn't reach there, they're going to be upset. That's how they are.
Yeah. So that's because, he said, use the word madrasa. It is a kind of madrasa where the goal is to look at it as an ideology mill where you indoctrinate people into the ideology. And so he said a few things that I thought were key. One thing is that employers should not hire people who graduate from these schools. I think that's the way to put it. There are two ways to put pressure on this. One is an employer should not hire people who graduate from these schools because they're not capable of reasoning honestly and thinking through a problem. The second thing is, and Gav, pull up our Don't Donate, Please. We started a campaign of Don't Donate to Your Alma Mater. And I think that this is extremely important to defund. Yeah, stop donating to your alma mater. This should be literally the easiest ask in the world. Nothing could possibly be more simple than this. Instead of asking, if you want to give National Progress Alliance money, that's great. Give us money. We put on people like yourself, other famous people, but we're only asking that you stop donating to your alma mater, because it is not the same institution that you graduated from? And again, this should be the simplest ask in the world. So we have two things. Stop hiring people from these institutions. Just stop. End of story, full stop. And it wasn't only Bill Ackerman. It was, I can't remember, somebody else. I can't remember who else. Maybe Reed can pull it up. Said they won't hire people graduating from these institutions. And the second is stop donating to your alma mater. I mean, it couldn't be any simpler than that. As a board member of Harvard Group that signed the statement on Israel, I think it was egregious and have resigned from my role. I am sorry for the pain it caused. My organization did not have a formal process, and I didn't even see the statement until we had signed on. Well, at least there's someone who has integrity. Keep in mind, Rajiv, the same people who are screaming up and down about cancel culture and wanting to cancel everybody, et cetera, the same people, you know, issued this letter. They themselves are now terrified of being canceled. They have the ideology in which they participated created this problem to begin with. And so, as you can see on the screen, Harvard students have deleted the pro-Hamas letter from its online location. And again, I encourage people to read that. Okay, so getting back to what you've written, I was curious about a couple of things. What lessons do you think Americans can learn from the treatment of Hindus in general, or maybe India more specifically? And if you could please explain the Breaking America force you mentioned on U.S. campuses. How's that related to India?
Right. So I wrote a book called Breaking India more than a dozen years ago. And I've been writing about it and talking about this syndrome for 20 years. And by the term Breaking India, I mean exactly what we are now calling wokeism, that breaks civilizations, breaks structures, breaks meritocracy, breaks the history, you know, abuses the founding fathers as oppressors. So breaking all the things that make a society successful, all the family, breaking family. So this I call Breaking India. And I talked about forces at that time, foreign forces coming from outside of India to capture different Indian groups based on identity politics, weaponize them, and encourage them to fight against the Indian nation. So I call that Breaking India. In the case of United States, the Breaking America is not coming from somewhere else. It is coming from within the United States. It's not like Chinese have sent some people, or Saudis have sent some people, or anybody like that, or Russians. It is like it's our own people in the United States that have turned against the country. So it is sort of like HIV virus. It's the immune system of the body that turns against the body. It's the very forces that are supposed to protect the body that turn against it. So in a sense, that's what's happening. Cancer is sort of like that. So one can have these analogies. This Breaking America is homegrown. It's a Marxism that came with Marcuse, around the Second World War from Europe to the United States in Berkeley, and Americanized itself and turned it into a kind of a race violence. And then the race violence became expanded with Islam wanting to join this union. So now this Breaking America is a coalition of the left, Islam, radical blacks who are trying to be racist, reverse racism, LGBTQ, and now a lot of Indians. A lot of Indians have joined, I'll tell you. The brief clip, we have some clips on Harvard professors, faculty members who are Indian, who are anti-India, anti-Hindu, anti-Jewish. They are the flag bearers of the woke movement. And so this is the Breaking India, Breaking America and Breaking India are kind of similar movements.
So in the reverse direction, what can Indians and Hindus learn from the recent backlash against Jews at Harvard?
So what they can learn is, I say kudos to the Jewish billionaires who've said, hey, you know, to hell with Harvard. We are not going to fund Harvard, like the example you just gave. I have actually tweeted and promoted these examples of Jewish billionaires who are leaving Harvard, scolding Harvard, reprimanding them and taking them on, because I think Indian billionaires need to do the same. In my book, Snakes in the Ganga, I have talked about a couple of dozen major funding sources of Harvard that are Indian. These are very wealthy Indian people, and they're funding the Ivy Leagues because they get a seat at the table. It's very prestigious. They get their kids into college, into Harvard. They get financial deals. Maybe they make business deals with rich American people. So they join sort of the white man's club in a liberal kind of a path into the white man's club. And this is part of their inferiority complex. The Indian billionaires suffer inferiority complex. No matter how much money they've made, they still don't feel secure unless they've joined this club. And the way you join the club is you give tens of millions of dollars to Harvard. They name a chair or a center after you. Your kids go there and you're felicitated as a big shot. So this is what Indian billionaires can learn, that you should stand up for principles. You should stand up for your heritage, for your country, for your culture, for your religion.
And for your sovereignty.
Sovereignty. And, you know, you should not sell out, because today's Indian billionaires, if you look at their parents' generation and their grandparents' generation, they were very patriotic. They were very loyal to their tradition. They were very Hindu, and they were not embarrassed of it. Ironically, under the British, they were the ones who were fighting for Indian sovereignty. And now these people, their own progeny, who become very rich, are ashamed of it. And so this is what the Indians can learn from the Jewish people, that you should stand up for who you are and not be ashamed of it. And since the billionaires are not doing this, fighting back Harvard and all that, I'm encouraging the public to stop supporting these billionaires. You should either boycott their products or put pressure on them.
Yeah, so I have to say, it's incredibly frustrating to me. You've been screaming about this. I've been screaming about this for a long time. And only now are people starting to pay attention. I remember people used to think I was a lunatic. You know, I would say this is we need to be careful. These bodies of there are bodies of literature. Because, it's not happening, or it's just a few fringe people in fringe departments. Oh, it's just fringe departments. Oh, it's just humanities. It will never leak out. And it's incredibly frustrating that this is what it takes. Let us not confuse Palestinians with Hamas. Let us be very clear about what's going on here. And it's frustrating to me that it takes something like this before people pay attention. You know, to make a lateral move in the conversation, it's frustrating to me, and I was just talking to Reed about this last night, this whole Ibram X. Kendi thing and corruption and anti-racism. I mean, it was so stupid. It was so freaking idiotic right from day one, all of it. And BLM, the whole thing, the corruption to the core, paying for people's mansions, that's a big thing, evidently, with Kendi and the BLM paying corruption, paying for multiple mansions. But, you know, it was just so many people fell for this and were hoodwinked by this. It is the stupidest possible thing. And now that we see the defund the police movement, other manifestations of craziness across the United States. And now we have this institutionalized, vehement Jew hatred, you know, from the same people who are screaming up and down about microaggressions all day long, microaggressions, trigger warning, safe spaces. And we have people openly calling for the death of Jews. Jewish students don't feel safe. They turn a blind eye. No statements. I remember when they were beating Jews in the streets, and I put out to my place, I won't mention now, where I used to work, why don't you criticize? It has nothing to do with Israel. Say, look, let us not beat people in the streets on the basis of perceived ethnic origin or perceived religion. Like, that shouldn't even be a low bar, right? But it's this selective, they select what causes they want. They should either get out of it entirely, or which the former Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, wanted to do, just no more federal funding. That's it. Boom. We're a racist organization. Okay, you're racist. Boom. Federal. We're going to investigate you. We're going to pull all your federal funding. This is just, it is stupidity upon stupidity. And so many people have fallen for this. And it's so frustrating and it's so disheartening. And now we're finally seeing the fruit of this, but only now are some people waking up and saying, oh, gee, you know, maybe there's an issue with the same people promoting microaggressions. Oh, gee, maybe it's an issue with the same people who are, I stand with Palestine. So to be clear, the rape of women, the kidnapping, these are not, it's not as if they went after, and I'm not advocating this, but I'm saying that there's a fundamental distinction that has to be drawn. These are civilians. These were people dancing at a rave. These were people who were hunted down and brutalized. And so the same people advocating critical race theory, the same people advocating anti-racism, the same Ibram X. Kendi, now Ta-Nehisi Coates, et cetera. This is what we see. And so I guess it's a little frustrating. Sorry about that rant, but it's just so frustrating to me that only now do people wake up to this. And that's why I'm so glad you're talking about India and Hindus, because that's not something we focus nearly enough on.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm very happy at the Jewish pushback, because so many people who dismissed me all these years, 20 years, they said, you're sensationalist, you're a conspiracy theorist, you know, you're just looking for trouble. You had a comfortable life, you were making lots of money, and you should have just enjoyed the good life. Why are you sticking your neck out? And what, there's nothing you're getting out of it. My relatives, my classmates from college, all of them in very elite, prestigious positions in the Indian government, many of them in the United States, would actually want to distance themselves from me because I would say things that were controversial. But now all of a sudden, because the Jewish billionaires are well-known people, highly respected people, because they're pushing back, I have people from of Indian origin and Hindus now contacting me and saying, you know, you were right. I mean, these guys are saying what you said for a long time. And so actually this is very useful for me, this moment of Harvard pushing back on people, places like Harvard and others, is very good, because finally I can say that after 25 or 30 years of work I did, finally I think that there are other forces in the mainstream that are jumping in. So I'm very happy about pushback against the whole leftist woke anti-Hindu kind of crowd.
Yeah, anti-meritocratic, vehemently anti-capitalist in kind of an uncritical way, you know.
Also like to say that in addition to the anti-meritocratic, which is of course very sad, I would also say that essentializing the categories of oppressor and oppressed is a completely nonsensical idea. To say that all people of a certain identity are oppressors and all people of a certain identity are oppressed is completely wrong. I mean, there are white oppressors, but there are white oppressed. I mean, I know a lot of whites who are oppressed. There are black oppressed, but there are also black oppressors. There were black slave owners. There are black churches. There's all kinds of, there are Muslim oppressors, but they are exempt. Muslim oppressors are exempt. They're not going to be taken to be exposed, and there's no fight against, you know, Islam as an oppressive structure, because they need them as a partner. They need them as the fighters who go out and hit out. So the left needs the Muslims as useful fighters. Now, I come from a background in India where my father, I just want you to people to know this, my father had to leave Lahore when Pakistan was created because the Muslims wanted a separate state. So he suddenly found himself in the wrong place, as a Hindu, and many of his family were killed. He was a young man, just newly married, and my mother and he had a child, my eldest brother, who died in this turmoil because of the killings that were going on. So I am a product of Islamic oppression. And the Muslims had ruled over India for 1,000 years, and they did not come, on a picnic tour. They came as invaders, as oppressors, as conquerors, and they were very proud of all the people that they killed. They slaughtered tens of millions of Hindus during this Islamic period, which is very well documented. They burnt down temples. They destroyed a lot. So, you know, from thousands of years, thousands of miles away in the Middle East, these guys come wave after wave of armies to destroy. So I in my heritage, I am the oppressed as far as that relationship is concerned with Muslims. My entire community are the oppressed. We were refugees, had to leave the our place of so I am a product of the refugees who were oppressed. Many of us were killed. So now, because based on meritocracy, I'm successful, I'm considered the oppressor. This is so strange. Why, you know, if you look at the stories of many of these Indians who've done very well in the United States and who are classified as oppressors, if you really look at them, they come from very ordinary, modest backgrounds. There is no oppression in their ancestry as far as the facts are concerned. But this is identity politics. And this, I think, the classification of oppressors and oppressed in a sweeping way is totally wrong. It is racist, and it is totally against the principles of liberalism.
Yeah, not only is it totally wrong, it's just stupid. It's demonstrably false. I was thinking about your story, which was moving. You know, my ancestors were in a genocide. But imagine teaching children, teaching kids not only, when I say children, I also mean K through 12, such a simplistic, Paulo Freire way of looking at the world, redefining terms of racism to include privilege and power. And, well, you know, you can't have racism if you don't have the power. Okay, well, by that stretch, you could look at, you know, white farmers in the sub-Sahara who don't have any power. Mozambique, Zimbabwe. I mean, it's just the whole, it's just so stupid that I just would love to be spending my intellectual energy doing something other than talking about something so utterly idiotic. But, you know, now we have chance of, you know, gas the Jews in Australia. We have vehement anti-Semitism. I have friends I was speaking to last night who were Jewish. They told me that they've never been so scared and afraid. You know, this day of jihad, fortunately, almost nothing came of that. I don't know. I obviously don't have a crystal ball. But I just find this to be so sickening. It's way beyond disturbing. It's just sickening to me. And we know where this comes from. We know this comes from university departments. I mean, it's ancient and it's historical, but it's never been a part of the canon, which has been institutionalized in teaching people in our academic systems like it is now. And that's a terrible, terrible problem. And it's disgusting to me that this is what it took to wake up most people. Now, hopefully, we're going to see the rapid fall of the ideology and we can all start doing something more productive. But by the way, you know, you said something that was interesting. You said people will come up to you and they've said, Rajiv, you're correct. I'm going to make a prediction to you. Nobody is going to come up to you and say, Rajiv, I'm sorry. I'm sorry I said bad things about you. I'm sorry I called you a racist or a Nazi or whatever stupid thing they called you. I'm sorry I shouldn't have done it. That's my prediction to you. I'm sorry not necessarily that I got hoodwinked by insane, deranged ideas like anti-racism or white fragility. White fragility is also like one of the stupidest things. Can you imagine that? I was just telling Reed last night. It's really a case of special pleading. Like, why is it that your denial of something is evidence of your guilt only in this one thing, but nothing else? So if I accuse you of being a radish and you say, what are you talking about? I'm not a radish. And you say to me, well, your denial of the fact that you're a radish is evidence of the fact you're, why is that only operative with racism? Like, has nobody said, like, geez, this is the kind of thing that you know, happened at the Salem Witch Trials, or that, you know, young teenagers, you know, like tweens, preteens do when they call each other stuff on the playground. Oh, you know, you're something. No, I'm not. Yes, you are. That proves you are. I mean, the whole thing is so idiotic. It's so utterly idiotic. But that's my prediction to you. I predict nobody's going to come to you and say, you know what? I broke my friendship off with you. I told you were on the wrong side of history. I wouldn't have a conversation with you when I should have. Nobody's going to say they're sorry for that. Literally nobody.
And that is true. That is absolutely true. I mean, I think, but I'm happy that without apologizing to me, they're making quietly an adjustment in their own thinking. I mean, as long as they change, They don't have to attribute it to me, but as long as they change, at least something is going in the right direction. At least some part of my work was successful. And I think there is an impact. The work you're doing, the work I'm doing, people are taking notice of this. People are not going to acknowledge it, but they are noticing it. And, you know, luckily I have a young following of Indians and Hindus who are getting empowered to fight back. We are a minority. We don't have the educational institutions in India on our side. They're all on the other side. Right. We don't have the mainstream media on our side. We do have the social media like we are on right now. So we are a force, a small minority, but we are a force. I'm 73. I won't live to see the fruits and the rewards of all this, but I'm convinced in the next generation, we are making a difference.
Yeah, I hope you're right. I want to revisit something you said. So yes, I am glad that people are coming out and saying you're right. I also think there is something in particularly the Catholic notion of repentance. I think that there's something in this idea of just saying like, I'm sorry, I was wrong. I repent isn't exactly the right term, but, and you know, not doing it again, or something that's just recognizing that the way you treated people because you yourself fell prey to a completely idiotic worldview. There is something about apologizing. There's something that has value in not a kind of contrition, but in a kind of humility when you've done something wrong. I mean, Aristotle talks about it's good to feel shame, but you shouldn't do a bad thing to feel shame, right? There's something about saying I'm sorry to people when you're wrong. There's also, by the way, I think it's really important. There's something if you move like you do, you know, for those of you who are Americans and not familiar with your work, you're one of India's premier public intellectuals. There's something when you move at high levels in a space that if you're wrong about something, it's really important to say, you know what? I screwed up. I was wrong about something. I'm publicly acknowledging. I mean, I've done that. I was wrong about a lot of things. The most recent thing was I myself have spent a career trying to not be hoodwinked and trying to help other people not be hoodwinked. And I was hoodwinked by the Hunter Biden laptop story, which in retrospect was quite something. But there is something about saying publicly, look, I believe this, I made a mistake, and putting it out there. I think that fosters the virtue of intellectual integrity.
Yes, but you know, the way we'll win is not by having the intellectual integrity of those who've wronged us apologizing. The way we'll win is that the future, the new people coming into colleges, yeah, and universities, young people in media are going to take that gospel they're being fed, that dogma they're being fed with a pinch of salt. And they now have a counter narrative thanks to your work, my work. I mean, my books have been bestsellers. I've written 13 of them. I'm going to write another 10 or 15 of them. So people are reading these things and they're having conversations. So, you know, we are creating a counter narrative, and it's not the old guard that's going to change because they have too much invested. They're too old. They're not going to repent. They have too much career at stake. They're not going to say my entire life work was wrong. They're not going to do that. Yeah. They should, as a matter of integrity, but they won't. So we will win by just making them irrelevant and bringing in new people. And that, I think, is working. And that, I think, has a lot of hope.
Yeah, I would love to agree with you. I just, there are reasons for optimism and there are reasons for pessimism. One of the reasons I'm pessimistic is because these people have jobs for life. These institutions are totally captured. I mean, they're just gone. True.
Yes.
University systems, they're just totally gone. You know, many people are trying to work to change the system. A presidential candidate, DeSantis, is trying to work to change the system, but I'm not particularly encouraged. I also acknowledge that building new things like the University of Austin takes time. I'm not going to be Pollyanna about it. It takes time. And, you know, creating an alternative educational system that can compete in the marketplace. I don't know. Vivek Ramaswamy, he wants to do it at the Department of Education. We can have that. That's another conversation entirely. He's talked about changing the accreditation system for universities, which is kind of a big racket now, how that's run. But I'm more sanguine in some senses, and in others I'm not. All right, let me fire off some questions to you, if I may, and sure. We'll just do a kind of
one comment here, which is relevant to what you just said. So this is where my other career, which is in artificial intelligence, way back, right, and then I left it, becomes relevant. I think the future is not through the same institutions that have run the show intellectually till now, because AI is disrupting the very concept of education. So what is going to happen is machine learning. The problem is that machine learning is being trained on woke ideology. That's the problem. Correct. So the future teachers are machines, are algorithms. Algorithms are going to make policies. Algorithms are going to educate people. Algorithms are going to decide who gets what job. And if these algorithms are biased, which they are, we got a problem. So the highest leverage intervention I can think of is to get into the field of machine learning and train machines to be different than the woke ideology, than the Marxist leftist ideology, which is all these machine learnings are learning from Wikipedia and New York Times and all of that stuff that Harvard turns. That is the material being used as data sets to train
machines
to think. So we need to capture the chat systems, these systems that are generative AI systems, and train them to think differently than the woke ideology. This is, to me, it's a huge project, needs a lot of funding, but I would love to put the rest of my life into that if somebody is interested.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. I heard a fantastic conversation I cannot recommend highly enough between John Vervaeke and Florence Reed at Unheard, who talked about AI, and it was really interesting about being born into the current world of insanity that we're living in. But if people have a chance, maybe Reed can stick that conversation in the comments. All right, so let's do this. I have a bunch of questions for you, if I may, that I'd like to just do a kind of rapid fire, where I ask you the question quickly and then you just give a response. Is that cool? Is that good?
Absolutely. Yeah, let's go. Yeah.
Okay. How do the global left and radical Islam collaborate to fight various civilizations as oppressors?
So, you know, Harvard has produced World Economic Forum as an example. It's a Harvard product. People should know that. And Harvard produces people who go and populate World Bank and various UN bodies and international organizations. So now what has happened is this kind of an ideology, this kind of a globalist, what they call globalist ideology, this climate control and human rights, social justice, and so on, has been populated by the Harvard thinking. And this is how the global left, and with a lot of influence from the Islamists, has started taking over the international arenas. And that's an important point one should know. I know people in the World Bank who've told me that some ultra-left wokists have come and given talks on social justice. And they've argued that World Bank policies on giving loans to developing countries should factor whether that the recipient of that loan has enough wokeism, they don't use that term, has enough social justice. In other words, one of the criteria by which borrowers will be evaluated before they get loans will be on whether they're complying with the ESG, DEI, these kind of things.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a serious matter.
All right. So let's go back to the Harvard thing. So speaking of Harvard, so you've mentioned that the Indian left is deeply embedded inside the American left. So could you please quickly tell us, like, how did that come about? And so why are Indian social science scholars and human rights activists part of Harvard's woke army?
So, you know, the history is that during the Soviet era, the Soviet Union invested a lot in creating an Indian left and they put them in universities. So the education department, the education ministries were controlled by leftists in India for the last, 30, 40, 50 years. when the Soviets collapsed, a lot of these people went, they didn't get funding from the Soviets anymore, but they got very good jobs in Harvard, Princeton, all these places, because they were very eloquent, they were well-educated, they were intelligent, English speaking. So a whole, the Gayatri Spivak, Homi Bhabha type of that generation arrived at that point in time. And they created a sort of a center for Marxism with Indian origin people. But it wasn't mainstream. It was sort of on the fringes. It was like a ghetto, you know, on campus where these guys talked about, you know, from the leftist point of view, they talked about British colonizers and things like that. It became mainstream. It started becoming mainstream when, you know, about 20 years ago, people like Harvard started funding, putting a whole lot of money to bring Indian scholars, Indian young faculty members to places like Harvard through their different departments and indoctrinate them, train them, and send them back. So this is what created a huge leftist woke army of Indian people. And because they're English speaking and very smart guys, they men, women, they have become a large part of the fighting force of the international woke army. You will find a lot of these protests against Israel. You will find that the Indians are involved. There are a lot of Indian people involved in these. You'll find them in England. So that's how the left has globalized itself, truly globalized itself. And this is a problem. The conservatives have not joined forces and globalized themselves. They're still fighting within the confines of a particular nation.
Yeah, it's interesting. While you were speaking, it made me think about something, about how difficult it is to kind of piecing together parts of our conversation, how difficult it would be and how intellectually embarrassing it would be to have fallen for something like white fragility. Like, just think of how embarrassing it is that you actually believed that your denial of something is evidence of that thing. Your denial of your racism. How embarrassing. So because it's so embarrassing, I mean, it's an intellectual embarrassment. Because it's so embarrassing, you wouldn't want to, you'd be like the last holdout. And the only consequences, instead of saying, geez, I made a mistake, this is ridiculous, you'd say, I never believed that. You have to gaslight. Oh, I never believed that. Like, I just never believed that to begin with. But I see that principle operative within the context of the question about social science scholars and this critical social justice. So the other thing that you've written about, let me segue real quick to these, let's do these rapid fire. So the critical social justice left, the proponents are creating a fourth world that unites all kinds of quote unquote oppressed people. Just bracket for a second that's a kind of an idiotic term that is usually looked at in terms of race as opposed to anything else as a quick variable, people to overthrow oppressive structures. So could you comment on the left is creating a fourth world, uniting all kinds of oppressed, quote unquote, people to overthrow oppressive structures?
So there is a faculty member at Harvard called Dr. Suraj Yengde. I've written a lot about him in this book. He has started this fourth world movement to try and bring together, Indian so-called oppressed and Palestinians and blacks and people of the fourth world to fight the whole world order. So this is what's going on. And they have numbers because there are a lot of people who are not well-educated. They fall for this. A lot of poor people who are looking for a way, an outlet for their anger. And such people, because of the Harvard prestige, have been given a lot of jobs on Capitol Hill as internists. A lot of the Democrats have, interns and, people who work in their offices in various capacities that are actually from this kind of a background. So the fourth world movement is the Harvard term for, the oppressed of the world coming together and fighting the whole established order.
Yeah, it's funny. And if you don't like the order that we've established, wait until you see the order that they'd like to put in. Anarchy, tyranny, Chaz zones. So I often have this maybe it's a fantasy. I don't know if everybody who wants to live like that will just, you know, section off some piece of the world, give it to them, see, come back in 50 years, see what happens, but they can't leave. You talk about some big Indian industrialists who fund these critical social justice studies at Harvard. Why do you do that?
So these Indian billionaires are looking for limelight. They're looking for business deals. They're looking for their family to get places in Harvard and to be serenaded as big shots. You know, they want to enter this world of elitism because they made lots of money and they don't want to be just sort of in the pigeonhole as Indians. They want to become global citizens. So the way to do it is you drop in $50 million or whatever it is. You drop in some bunch of money into a place like Harvard, have a thing named after you. And that is something that Harvard is encouraging. They have, you know, Harvard has a huge infrastructure in India. They have in Mumbai and they have in Delhi. And they have big offices. And they network the alumni and get them jobs, get them positions. They do very well for the people who are Harvard alumni, and the alumni are supposed to be loyal to them. So it's a kind [S2] Yeah. [S1] it's a kind of a very large scale mafia in a sense. And they've entered the governments. So this is a very serious thing. As you said, it's not going to go away. It's not very easy to fight this, because when I argue with my friends who are Harvard products and who are propagating all this, they will say, even if they agree ideologically on a personal level, they'll keep it private. And then they'll say, I had a conversation just yesterday with a lady who's one of those people. And she said, you know, I have too much at stake. I support you, but I cannot say it publicly. And this is a problem. This is a very serious problem.
Okay. So couple more. Why do some, let's see. So you talk about China using Harvard to undermine India and the US. And I think this is something we don't talk nearly enough about. So I was wondering if you could talk about that, particularly given recent tensions between the U.S. and, or not even recent, but fairly recent tensions between the U.S. and China.
Right. So, you know, in the book, we have several chapters on how China infiltrated the Harvard, set up chairs and brought in a whole lot of students. Some of them were spies. And also China, it's a very important point. China does not want wokeism at home. And the Saudis don't want wokeism at home, and the Iranians don't want wokeism at home. And yet China is very happy to have wokeism in the Western world and in India, because it'll destroy those countries. And the Islamists are part of this wokeism, but they're not going to take it to Saudi Arabia. They're not going to take it to Iran. So the interesting thing is that out of the chaos that you talked about a moment ago, comes an opportunity for the Chinese and the radical Islam countries. China and Islam have a lot to gain from the destruction and demolishing of the rest of the world. And wokeism is like useful idiots that can help them do the job. So I see the world in that sense. I see that the Chinese are sitting back and having a good laugh because we are destroying each other and destroying ourselves, and they are staying out of it. And this is why they are indirectly always promoting these things.
Yeah, wokeism is a universal solvent. My friend Faisal Al-Muttar from Ideas Beyond Borders was telling me that the Chinese and the Russians, I don't know about the Russians anymore, they seem to be a little bit preoccupied, but through the Middle East, we're pumping out BLM propaganda and other critical social justice narratives and propaganda. It's just so divisive and toxic again, and I'm hoping that it's in its final days here, so we'll see soon enough. Well, you've been extremely generous with your time. Is there anything else you'd want to throw out or talk about or add? And Reed, do we have any super chats?
So I will just throw out one final thing, and that is, sure, I would like that the conservatives in the United States and Europe should take a serious look at Hindu phobia and collaborate with the conservatives in India, because we have a common enemy which is going to destroy all of us. And while the left is unified across national boundaries, across religions and all of that, the conservatives that are fighting them are in separate cocoons. People like me need collaborators in people like you. And so we need that. We need that from each other. We need to compare notes. We have common counter narratives, common arguments. And that's the hope I have coming out of conversations like this.
Yeah, and I think I want to punch home something. And if there is a disagreement, like so if you and I have a disagreement, we agree upon the rules of engagement for how to discuss that. Like, I'll present my evidence. I'll listen to you. Well, first I'll listen to your evidence. I'll present it. I'll give counter evidence. I'll present my evidence. And so we have a framework for rational civil conversation and discussion. And one of the things that we're losing, hopefully we've not lost entirely, I don't think we have, but is the common framework by which we can engage each other civilly and rationally. And the deeper the gulf, I wrote that about this and how to have impossible conversations, the deeper the gulf, the more important that is to do. So
instead of calling it conservative versus liberal, I think we should call it rational people, meritocracy people. We should talk about values rather than branding labels, identities. We should say people who are rational and meritocratic should come together and fight those who are not.
Yeah, and I would add the access of authoritarian. I am not an authoritarian. I want people to live any kind of lives that they want to lead with certain obvious caveats of not hurting other people. And so if you're not willing to step across a divide and have conversations with people or reach agreements with people for whom that would have otherwise been at least difficult, then I would argue that you're part of the problem. Not you, but one would be part of that problem.
I agree with that.
So where can people find you?
So you should go to rajivmalhotra.com. I have a website. On the Twitter, it's called, my handle is Rajiv Message. And in YouTube, it is Rajiv Malhotra Official. I have a large following on Facebook. I stopped doing too much on Facebook because they're censoring me, but I used to have 6.5-7 million followers. I still do. But and that also, the handle is Rajiv Malhotra Official. So you can reach me there, and I would love to interact with people. I'd love to have more discussions, debates, arguments. I'm open to receiving criticisms as long as it's rational and both sides can speak.
Perfect. Thank you so much. I genuinely appreciate your time. Stay on the line, and Gav's going to play a quick message. And thanks, everybody, for your time for Conversations with Peter Boghossian. Special thanks to Sir Rajiv Malhotra. It's an honor.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody. Yep.